So this is what we're going to do today. We're going to start talking about Megillat Esther. And I know you don't have to like remind me. I know that the class is a class in Agadah. But what we're going to do is we're going to read through the prism of certain qualities of personality, which is mentioned in the Agadah. And we're going to use that to reread the story of Esther. If I really have three classes, I don't know if I only have two or three. If I have three classes, then I'll also give another one about maybe about Mordechai and Esther. But today I want to talk really much more about the book, about Megillat Esther. And as I said, I'm going to use rabbinic statements, and they're going to teach us something. Any of the sources that I use, I'm happy to send them to you later. But meanwhile, all that I really need is your imaginations. So I want to start with sometimes you can have a movie and then they make a sequel, like afterwards, what happened to all the characters. But every now and again, somebody gets clever and they decide they're going to make a prequel, what happened before the whole thing. So I wrote a chapter, a prequel, to the Book of Esther. Right? What does that mean, I wrote it? I wrote it. I made it up completely. Actually, the whole class for today and whatever next time, I wrote up as an essay, so if anybody wants to read it, I'm happy to share that as well. But here is my prequel to the book. And one of you maybe one day will make movies, so we'll make a movie out of it. We're definitely going to do this. So here's how it begins. It starts off in a very dingy, dusty stable, horses making noise, hay sort of flying around the room. You know, like the scene where you have like the dust like going through and like the ray of light coming through the dust. And then there's a guy there who's like shoveling and literally shoveling the stuff that horses produce. And that's what his job is. He's cleaning up all the stuff but then you follow like this ray of light, which is coming through the window. And again, dancing, all the dust is dancing over there. And then you see all the way through the sun coming through. And he walks over and like towards the window and he looks. And as you know, you look back in the light, you see an enormous castle in the background. And his eyes then, or our camera, will then focus on the second floor in the castle. Because in the second floor, there's a balcony. And on the balcony, there's a young woman. And this young woman is brushing her hair, oblivious to anything around her. Beautiful, beautiful spring day. Also oblivious to the fact that there's some guy who's watching her from inside the stable. And as he looks at her, and he looks at the palace, and the palace is actually the palace of the whole country, and she is the daughter of the king. She's a princess. And as he looks at her, he says, "One day she'll be mine." And we're not completely sure, even though we really are. Is he talking about her? Is he talking about the palace? Is he talking about the country? And the answer to all of that is yes. So in our prequel now, our two protagonists, she, of course, is a young woman named Vashti. She's beautiful. And by the way, along the way, as much as I possibly can, I am going to point out to you things that it actually says in the Book of Esther, as opposed to things that we think it says because they got to us. Who the they are? Those are the people that you've paid lots of money to indoctrinate you, but they got to you. Because there are certain things that you think it says and it doesn't say it, and certain things that you don't think it says and it's actually staring there at you. So I'm going to point out as many as I can. Vashti is described as being beautiful. So here you have a young Vashti. She's beautiful. She's a princess. Now, what exactly does it mean that she's a princess? It means that she's aristocratic. It means that she's brought up as a princess. You know, what else can you say? But this other person, our other protagonist, his name, of course, is Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is the guy who's working in the stable, you know, probably as low of a job as you can have. The only good side about his job, even though it's really low, is that he is in the outskirts of the palace and he does work somehow within the realm of the palace. But he has designs. He has decided himself that he is too good for this life, for this kind of life, and he sees himself as being completely upwardly mobile, and he has decided that he will one day be king. Now, he actually has no real option of being king, because the only way you could be king is by being the son of a king, and he's not the son of a king. So for him to be king, being a lowly stable boy, there's only one way for him to do it, and that is essentially a violent, bloody takeover of the palace, of the country, and for that matter, of Vashti. So what I'm beginning with now is actually two statements which are found in the Gemara. One statement is that Vashti was the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Now that's really important, because Nebuchadnezzar was the one who destroyed Nebuchadnezzar was the one who destroyed the first Beit HaMikdash, which means in terms of a topography, topography of a personality, this is somebody who has destroyed that which is holy, which means he's a king, he's powerful, but he's a bad king. He's a bad king because as far as our biased perception is, or perspective is concerned, he's the one who destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. So therefore, he can have a son and he can have a granddaughter, and these are people who are the continuation of this particular line of unholy power. I'm gonna just use that to understand where the Gemara is coming from. Because the Gemara says, oh, granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, it's not saying that she's necessary. I mean, we know nothing about her, by the way. There's only one thing we know about her so far, that she's beautiful. There's a second thing we know about her, but we don't know that we know it yet. So again, I'm going to hold off. I'll tell you soon when we know it. But we do know it already. We just don't realize that we know it. And that has a lot to do with her name, because you always have to be careful about names. So Ahasuerus is, we'll be told very soon, was a stable boy. That's something which we're told. When we're told it, now we need a little bit of more context. The story begins, and now I'm going back to what it actually says in Megillat Esther. The book begins as follows. V'yihi bimei Achashverosh, in the days of Achashverosh, hu Achashverosh hamolech, he is the Achashverosh who ruled. Incidentally, I hear, not just me, but I hear a person who usurped the power, because it doesn't say Achashverosh, the son of the previous king. It says Achashverosh who ruled, which means he was somebody who took over the kingdom. He ruled Mehodu v'ad Kush, Sheva v'esrim me'am medina. It sounds like a great place. Now, in the first couple of verses now, we're going to learn something else. He makes two parties, and what I want you to think about is what is his motivation in making these parties? What is he trying to accomplish? What is he trying to do? Why is he doing this? And what I want you to do in order to understand this is actually to think very politically. See, most of us, when we read the book of Esther, we don't think in terms of politics. Rather, we think in terms of religion. We think, oh, like we always think, we're Jews, they're trying to kill us, and we're going to be saved, and we'll make a holiday out of it. But I don't want you to read it like that. That's going to be the end of the story, but that's not the beginning of the story. The beginning of the story is a man who becomes king. And when he becomes king, well, actually, here's the second. I'm going to have two chapters of my prequel. Here's my second chapter of the prequel. The second one is after he becomes king. How does he become king? So the answer is a bloody battle. He takes people and they kill the whole old leadership. Now, what is the relationship between Vashti and Achashverosh? So if any of you tell me husband and wife, I will be very disappointed. What is the relationship like? Tell me about how they get along with one another. Or husband, by the way, but yeah. Yeah, we don't even think about that, yeah. He probably killed either her husband and or her father. Yeah, if there's a husband, we're making that up. But so the second scene, therefore, would be a night or two or three after he now has moved into the palace. You've seen these scenes so many times. They're sitting at a long table full of food and full of every single, you know, sign of wealth. Mm-hmm. She's sitting at one side of the table. He's sitting at the other side of the table. Does she have an appetite? So, but he orders food to be put on her plate, right? He's the kind of guy who will tell his wife what she's eating, right? Right. So why? Because that's who he is, and he has the food put on her plate, and she picks up her silverware and she like plays with it a little bit, but she can't actually bring herself to eat anything. What's he doing on the other side of the table? He's got like a whole leg of lamb in his hand. He doesn't know anything about a fork and knife, very clearly. He's got like a big, big glass full with wine, which is spilling over the top and staining everything, of course. And he's eating and he's drinking like a pig. And she's looking at this, and what is she saying to herself? By the way, I'm not even going to the bedroom right now. What is she saying to herself? Total revolt, right? Which is, you can imagine her turning around and vomiting just out of total nausea and disgust at this man. And I'm going to say it one more time. They haven't even gotten to the bedroom yet. And she is sick. She is sick because look at what her life has now become. Which means 10 minutes before this rebellion took place, she was a princess. Everything was great. Her life was wonderful. She can, I'm going to say it again now, absentmindedly brush her hair off on the balcony with the sun shining in her hair, and her life is great and everything is perfect. And then the next day turn around and everything is gone and all the people that she loves are dead. And now there's, you know, blood literally spilled in the palace as the dead bodies are dragging it away. And some new guy now has moved in and says, yeah, I'm the king right now. And you're my wife, which means she is most literally a trophy wife, more than any woman could ever be described, right? She's a trophy. She is a sign of conquest. The same way that he has conquered the palace on the country, he now has her. Does that help us a little bit with understanding the relationship? So I'm going to say it again. I made up these two scenes, and I'm going backwards to understand what the relationship is, which means she looks at him in total disgust. He looks at her as, I've made it, right? She's a sign of his accomplishments. And she, let's now get to the party. The book begins with two parties. Do you remember this? Do you remember who the two parties are for? Because it's really interesting and totally counterintuitive.
The Jews.
Well, no, the Jews are not even involved.
Well, I think one's for the country, one's for the capital.
So listen to who he invites to the first party. Because again, what I want you to think is in political terms. It says, in those days, Bimi Mahim, when he's sitting at Kisei Malchuto, he's on his throne in Shushan Abira. Bishnat Shalosh Lemolcho. It's another thing that we tend not to pay any attention to. The timeline going throughout the whole book. Third year. Third year would probably be enough time to everything to calm down. Right? Everything to be established. Third year, he makes a party. Listen to who he invites. Bishnat Shalosh, this is Perek Aleph Pasuk Gimel. Bishnat Shalosh Lemolcho, Asa Mishteh. Notice the word Mishteh. There's two different words that could have been used. One would be a Se'uda. Se'uda would imply food. Mishteh implies
alcohol.
Why? Because Lishtot, to drink. Mishteh. The other thing I told you that you know about Vashti that you didn't know that you know is what's her name?
Vashti.
And what would be the connotation? Yeah, the one who's been drinking. So that's also what I want you to think about is why is she described as someone who's been drinking? Because there really is a great deal of drinking in the book. It's not just that the Jews decided, oh, we're going to celebrate Purim by drinking. We celebrate by drinking because the whole book is about drinking. I want to say one more thing about Vashti. And this, maybe you know, maybe you don't know, but it's actually really interesting. But it's really interesting how wrong it is, but that's my own biased opinion. In the late 20th century, Vashti became really popular among feminist and especially Jewish feminist writers. And they said, for a very simple reason, that here is somebody we can look up to. Because she knew how to fight the patriarchy. She knew how to tell, like a man, a king, a man of power, go to hell. Which means she is a woman who we can respect. On the other hand, Esther, for a lot of them, what kind of girl is Esther? She does whatever people tell her to do. And she's so early 20th century. She is this good girl. I mean, I read an article that says, Esther is like this good girl who I hate. Vashti has got a little bit of an edge to her, and therefore Vashti is somebody who's so much more impressive. I think that this feminist reading of Vashti is displaced. I don't think that this feminism over here, essentially, the sin that was committed to create that reading is the sin that all of us do when we read and we have to make sure that we're able to push it aside. This is one of my biggest fears when I wrote my first book, and that is, am I taking my own thoughts and forcing them on, you know, old characters, or have I effectively understood what's going on in the text? And I'm going to say it again. The main issue taking place right now is political. It is not a question of sexism as much as it's political issues taking place. Vashti is the daughter of the former king, and therefore, that is the main issue over here within the relationship over here, because she has been forced in a way that no person should ever be forced. But again, I want to say it's the political issue. When once you realize it's the political issue, you'll then either understand completely or be shocked with what he does next. So in the third year, Bishnat Shalosh L'Macho, Asam Mishteh, okay, specifically for drinking, L'Kol Sarav V'Avadav. He invites all of his, what is Sarav? A Sar is minister. The English translation I have here is princes. It's ministers. It's all the people in power. V'Avadav. And Avadav means servants. Now, did that make any sense to you? That he's going to invite two groups together that at face value have nothing to do with one another? One part of them are people of real power, and the other part of the group are total servants. But this actually tells you how clueless Ahasuerus is, or it's really how tone-deaf he is, which means he never seems to have the ability of interpreting data through the individual's perspective. The only thing he always does is through his own perspective. Before we finish today, I'm going to read to you what I believe is a proper psychological evaluation of Ahasuerus. I'm going to tell you again, I am totally making this up, but I think I'm right. But it'll actually, you know, solidify this point. So he's making a party, and essentially, who has he invited? What do these two groups have in common with one another? Servants and ministers. What do they have in common with one another? They serve him. By the way, isn't that a fascinating thing? Yeah, you all serve me. It's a fascinating statement, but they also have something else in common. Do you know what it is? Okay, I'm going to help you a little bit with his personality. Part of his personality dysfunctionality is that he will increasingly be, as the story will move on, more and more paranoid. Do you understand why he would be paranoid? Exactly. And that's the price he's going to pay for his success, is that there may be some other stable boy, cook, waiter, guard, minister, who's sitting around having the same fantasy that he had, that one day this will be mine, and he's going to take everything from him. And as I said, he's going to become, his situation is actually going to completely deteriorate. And somebody's going to help him with that also along the way, but that I'm getting ahead of myself right now. But he invites all people, and I think there's two issues here. One, they are the people that serve him, which is actually a terrible way of doing this, because you should treat people, you know, that have more power very different than others. This is not a political way of doing this. This is a very selfish way of doing this. But there's one more thing about these people, and that is most likely they have access. They have access to him. So it's all the people that have access to him are obviously going to be the people that he's most frightened of. So he makes a party. And how long does this first party last? It says it's in the third year he makes it for all of these people. He shows off all of his wealth. B'harato et osher kavod malchuto v'yikar teferet gedulato. Shows off all of his wealth, all of his power, all of his success. Yamim rabim shmonim umi'at yom. For 180 days. That's 6 months. That's longer than all of you have been on this program so far. You thought you guys have been partying. You should open up a new probe called the Ahasuerus program. Right? Party. 6 month party. 180 days. He makes a party, again, of alcohol. Alcohol flowing for 6 months. And that is for all the people that serve him and have access. When that... Good. I think what his message to them is, look how lucky you all are that I'm king, because I open up my wine cellar for all of you. I share with you everything that I have. Everything which is mine is yours, and therefore, you know, you guys are all in a... Meaning, you guys are not just sitting in the stable, shoveling, you're drinking my alcohol with me, and therefore, I'm a different kind of ruler. Of course, somebody just as easily can say, what a fool this person is. Why in the world is he drinking with the staff, and so on and so forth. But you realize, see, the other thing that I hope you're also getting from him is the amount of insecurity that he has. There's a great deal of insecurity to make a party like this for 180 days. Did you all hear that or feel that or not yet? Which means he's a bully. He's a bully, but he's his It's all insecurity. Because what happens deep down in his sleep, deep down when he can't fall asleep? Does he see himself as being king, or is he worried that people still see him as being a stable boy? Which means his sense of insecurity is profound, but that's because that's the price that he's going to pay for what he has done. So he makes his party 180 days for all the people that are servants. Yeah. Okay, first of all, I think you're right. That's first of all. Secondly, the Gemara actually has a great argument, which is not a usual argument, about Achashverosh. Was he really smart, but he did some dumb things? Or is he really dumb, but he does some smart things? Which, incidentally, when Rabbi Soloveitchik taught this Gemara, he said, that is the perfect indication of somebody who's paranoid. Do you want to hear the textbook definition over here? Paranoid personality disorder is a mental disorder, which, by the way, he develops. I'm going to say it again. It deteriorates. It gets worse as the time goes on. Is a mental disorder characterized by paranoia and persuasive long-standing suspiciousness and generalized mistrust of others. Individuals with this personality disorder may be hypersensitive, easily feel slighted, and habitually relate to the world by vigilant scanning of the environment for clues or suggestions that may validate their fear or biases. Is that word for word what you just now said? But now the question is, where is it coming from? Is it coming from really being smart or really being unease with himself? Which is, he's not the kind of guy that you really get the sense that he's comfortable in his own skin, he's comfortable in his environment, that he feels good about his life. He doesn't. He's somebody that there's always something on edge about, and I'll continue. Paranoid individuals are eager observers. They think they're in danger and look for signs and threats of that danger, potentially not appreciating other evidence. They tend to be guarded and suspicious and have quite constricted emotional lives. That's also very important. Which means he could be sitting with Vashti. Wow, isn't life great? And she's looking at him saying, yeah, life is great. I'd rather be dead. Life is great. But he has no ability of feeling her angst. He just has no care. I mean, it's not something that ever crossed his mind. I wonder how she feels today. I wonder how her day was, right? This is nothing to do about. Their reduced capacity for meaningful emotional involvement and the general pattern of isolated withdrawal often lend to a quality of schizoid isolation to their life experience. People with this particular disorder may or may not have a tendency to bear grudges, suspiciousness, tendency to interpret others' actions as hostile, persistent tendency to self-reference, or a tenacious sense of personal right. So what do you think about my description of Achashverosh now? Was that It's like, again, I just took this out of a psychology textbook, and yeah, he sounds textbook. He actually sounds it, and I agree with you 100% that 180-day party has multiple purposes, but even if it doesn't, he can't help himself. And he's always suspicious. And the best thing about it is, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that someone's not out to get you. And there are people who are out to get him, which actually makes the whole story a little bit more interesting as well. So he makes his party for 180 days. And it tells us all the things that he shows off and all of his possessions and so on and so forth. And then... Yes, that's a midrash. We read it. Ukelim, ukelim shonim. And he used various types of utensils. So that's where they get it from. So, uvemalot hayamim ha'ele, at the end of his 180-day binge, asa melech chol ha'am hanimtzaim b'shushan habira milimigdol v'ad katan. Then he makes a second party for the people who live in Shushan, the capital. Again, the only thing they have in common is geography, where they live. L'migdol v'ad katan. From the most prestigious, important, wealthy, powerful person to the lowest person. So he does the same thing two times. Ministers and servants, local people, no matter who they are. And he makes a second party, mishteh, again, wine flowing. Shivat yamim b'chatzer ginat bitan ha-melech. He makes another seven-day party. So that's interesting, that the first one was 180 days, and now for the locals, and maybe he doesn't want them to feel left out. Maybe they've been watching, you know, over the fence the whole time. But he makes a second one for 7 days. So far, this man, in the third year of his kingship, has been making parties for 180 days, another party for 7 days. And again, we're told about all the things that he shows off, and all the wine that has been flowing. And then it adds one more thing. I'm reading Pasuk Tet now, verse 9. Gam Vashti Hamalka. And now again, I want you to note her name. Her name is Vashti. She drinks. Why does she drink? Okay, so now let's start all over again. Why do people drink? People,
he's in depression.
Well, okay, good. So different people drink for different reasons. Some people drink because they're happy and they want to party and they're happy and everything is good. And some people, anybody who needs more shade, there's shade over here if you need it. Sarah, or, unless you just like to move every 3 minutes or so.
Because it gets cold and then...
I got it. So different people drink for different reasons. Some people drink because they're happy and some people drink because they're sad. So it says over here, Gam Vashti, and now again, I'm finally stressing it. Her name is Vashti. Why is her name is Vashti? That is who she is in this book. Who is she? She is this woman. We also don't know how old she is at this point. So I would say, I'm totally making everything up, so please forgive me. But I get to do this. Vashti, her best years have gone by already. She no longer cares that much about anything. Essentially, her life has been ruined. She doesn't have that much to do, to live for. And all that she does at this point is she drinks. And why does she drink? Because how else to get through the day? She drinks to get through the day, and then she has to drink again to get through the night. And essentially what I want you to really feel is that her life is a horrific, terrible life, which is such a fascinating contrast to, you know, that first scene that we heard, because she's a princess. She's a beautiful princess. Actually, if you're not sure about her beauty and you think I'm reading into it, and it says that Gam Vashti Yamaka Asta Mishteh Nashim. She makes a party for the women, Beit HaMalchut, Asher LeMelech HaChashverosh. She makes a party for the women in the royal palace. Who are the women that are drinking with her? All the other women who were the daughters or wives of the aristocracy who've all had their husbands murdered or their fathers killed, and they're all taken as captives, but I guess you can be a captive in a palace as well, or you'd be a captive in a beautiful home, which means she is drinking out of depression with all the other women who are drinking out of depression. By the way, if you're going to ask me how I know this, give me a couple seconds because I'll show you how I know this, which means there's two different parties going on. There's one party going on where Ahasuerus is saying, let's have, you know, we're having a great time over here, and he is happy. And then the total disconnect which takes place is between him and his wife, or between the men and between these women, because these women are the women who are all abused in every possible way. Am I saying this strong enough? I mean, do I need to say this any stronger? These are women whose lives have been raped. Everything about their existence right now is somebody stronger than, more powerful than, have taken over their lives, and they are sitting there and drinking because their lives are miserable at this point. When I say it again, why do people drink? Some people drink because they're happy, and some people drink in order to escape. And what's really interesting, and if you've never noticed it, there's an enormous amount of drinking that takes place in Megillat Esther, which is the reason why the rabbis ended up saying, yeah, one wants to celebrate this, realize this whole story is a story about excessive drinking along the way, which is really fascinating, because a lot of bad things happen because of excessive drinking. One of the things that happens is, now we're told, that on the seventh day, B'yom HaShvi'i, Kitov Lev HaMelech B'yayin, that also tells us something really important. What does that mean, Kitov Lev HaMelech B'yayin? That he's feeling totally happy, right? He's in a good place. He's finally feeling really good about himself. Amar Lemuman, and so on, there's various servants. Lavi et Vashti HaMalka. Now, how many of you have been indoctrinated to be told that she was brought naked? Okay, it doesn't say it. Just totally doesn't say it. But let's just pay attention to what it does say. Lavi et Vashti HaMalka. By the way, notice Vashti HaMalka, not Vashti, Vashti HaMalka, the queen. Why are we bringing her? Because she's the conquest. Why are we bringing her? Because she's the trophy wife. What has he done till now? He's shown up all of his wealth. So he has one more thing that he's captured that he wants to show off. And what's that? His wife who's been captured. Now, if you're Vashti, what do you do right now? And if you want me to be even clearer, Vashti HaMalka V'Melech Baketer, to come wearing her throne. So some rabbi, I don't want to say rabbi with a dirty mind, but some rabbi with a creative mind said, oh, she's only wearing her crown and nothing else. It's not what it says. It's actually the opposite. If you can ask me, pshat, he is not bringing her there in order to humiliate her. In this, why? Because he doesn't care about her. In order to try to humiliate somebody, you need to have at least some emotional sensitivity and know what somebody else feels. Do you get my point on this? You have to care about someone else's feelings to humiliate her. He's not trying to humiliate her because it's not about her. What is it about? It's about him showing off all the things that he has. And he's got gold, and he has silver, and he has wine, and he has a queen. And he wants to show off the queen. And this queen is not just the queen. The queen gives him legitimacy. She gives him legitimacy the same way the palace gives him legitimacy. She is the queen. And therefore, I'm going to read again what the words really say. Laviat Vashti Amalka, to bring Vashti, the queen. Lufnei Amelech Beketer Malchut, wearing her royal crown, which means, does he want her to look humiliated or does he want her to look good? And what's the answer? He wants her to look good. Why? Because he wants to show her off. Why? Because she's his trophy. And I'll say it one more time. He doesn't give a damn what she feels. It's not even that he doesn't give a damn. It's never occurred to him how she feels. Should I start all over again now? How does she feel? Does she have any choices? You always have choices. You just don't want to think about some of the choices. Good. That's good. Yes, you always have a choice. What's her choice? By the way, this is why she's a feminist hero. Because she says no. Sorry, not coming. Now, by the way, for him, do you realize how bad this is going to make him feel? This is what he's been working up to this moment all along, to show off his wife. And she says, you know, he wants her to look great. He wants her to wear the throne. He wants her to look regal. He wants her to look like a queen. I'm going to say it again. It's not that he wants her to look naked. It's not that he wants to humiliate her. He wants to show her off as his queen. Look what I have. Another one of my possessions. By the way, I'm going to read a little bit more. Lahaviat Vashti Amalka, Lefnei Amelech, to bring the queen Vashti, Biketer Malchut, wearing the royal crown, Laharot Ha'amim Vasarim Et Yafya, to show off to everybody her beauty, Kitovet Marehi. How should I translate that? Kitovet Marehi? Because she was really hot. No, that's not the right way to translate. Because she was really good looking. That's what it says. She was really beautiful. So he wants to show her off. But to Ma'ena Malka Vashti Lavo, she said no. So as far as did she have a choice, we don't want to think that she has a choice because it's easier to say I don't have a choice. So she's been drinking, he's been drinking, she's been drinking, she's depressed, he's been drinking, he's happy. He wants to show up everything that he has, and at that moment she comes and she humiliates him. By the way, what does he do to her? Never says that. And I love that it never says it. You're going to say, but it says it. Never says that he kills her. Because I think that it's too hard for him to kill her. How do you kill her? Yeah, well, I'm just saying it again. We never told what happens to her.
What?
Really good, right? It never says what happens to her. She sort of disappears. She gets removed. She's pulled off the stage. Did they... You now can go on in your imaginations. Of course, they cut off her head. Of course, they hung her. Of course, Gillet. There's probably a great deal of... What's the word?
Speculating.
No, that's true. That's correct. But there's probably ambivalence on his part. Do you kill her? How do you not kill her? What do you do? And he can't make a decision what to do. It's actually... He doesn't know what to do. And he turns to his advisors and says, what do I do? Which means, here's a man who had no problem probably killing lots and lots of people. He has blood on his hands in the most literal sense. I don't know if you ever imagine what he looks like. I have no idea what he looks like. But I would imagine that he was somebody who was very big and very strong and very ruthless and was very brave and probably would be willing to take all kinds of chances and kill people. He had no problem with that. But how do you kill Vashti? He's been dreaming about her for years. Right? How do I know it? Because I wrote a chapter saying that he's been dreaming about her. So of course that's the case. Because what do you do? He has to turn to his advisors now and say, what do I do? And it says that the advisors then come over and they say to him, she didn't obey my rules. What do I do? So it says, Lo ala melech levado avtavashti amalka. She didn't sin just against you. Ki al kol hasarim v'kol ha-mimasher kol midinot ha-melech ha-chashverosh. This is a sin which is going against all of us. Ki yetzi dvar amalka kol ha-nashim. Because all the women are going to listen, lavzot ba'alayim b'ineihem, in order to humiliate their husbands. Now, a misreading of this, and again, this is my, you're allowed to disagree with me. It's okay. What I think a mistake would be is to take 20th or 21st century sensibilities and read it into the text and say, oh, look, this is a question of feminism, but I have a secret for you. There was no feminism in Persia 2,500 years ago. I don't know how much feminism there's in Persia today. Which means this is not a male-female struggle. It's a struggle between classes. It's the aristocracy, the old aristocracy, and then the nouveau riche. It's this new violent criminal element who now replaced the old violent criminal element and took their wives and daughters. And if Vashti is able to tell Ahasuerus to drop dead and go to hell, I'm not coming out, and you're not going to show off my beauty, and I'm not one of your conquests, have a good life, enjoy your party, do what you want, but you don't own me. Right? Again, I don't know all the conversations she had with him. How brave was she? Did she, when he raped her the first time, did she say to her, you can have my body, but you'll never have my love? Did she say that line to him? I can make up lots of lines, by the way. But does it make a difference if she said it or not? Because that's how she feels. You will never have my love. You will never have my respect. I will never be yours. You could take me in any way that you want. I will never be yours. But Vashti wants to hold on to some type of dignity. Of course, she only succeeds in this when she gets completely drunk, Vashti. She drinks for 7 days. She drinks with the other women. They're completely depressed. And what kinds of things does a person do when they're completely depressed? Good, I finally got there. What do people do when they're completely, totally depressed? Yeah?
Kill themselves.
Or have somebody else do it for you. Which means she's at the point that she just doesn't care. Which means when we go back and say, but she doesn't have a choice, of course she has a choice. And her choice is so obvious right now. She's saying, I am not going to let this man abuse me anymore. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to be this thing that he gets to show off in front of his friends, in front of his people, in front of her, his drunkler. Which means the rabbinic comment that she was naked is really true emotionally. It's just not true physically. Did that line make any sense to you? Because she feels so vulnerable. She feels so much disgust towards him. She feels like she's being... And it doesn't make a difference what she's wearing, which is covering her up on a physical level. She just doesn't want to go there. But of course, Ahasuerus, having his personality, never thought about how she feels. Because what difference does it make how she feels? She is one of his possessions, and therefore she is something for him to show off. And therefore the only thing which is important, how she serves him, and she, again... That's this total disconnect. She's been drinking for 7 days. Her and the other women feeling worse and worse and worse. And you know, it starts off by saying what you said. We have no choice. This is our lives. And at some point she says, what do you mean we have no choice? We always have a choice. Watch. Watch me make a choice. Watch me make a decision. I'm not coming out. Enjoy your party. He doesn't know what to do. And now the advisors are saying, you better do something. By the way, that is the kind of thing that scares him more than anything else. You better do something now. How could they talk to a king like this? Because it's not just you. Because you're about to lose all the people that are surrounding you. You're about to lose your general. You're about to lose all the officers. Because all of them have wives who've been obeying them because they took over the palaces and they took over the mansions and they took over the wives and they took over the daughters. And if Vashti gets away with this, then you will have a total breakdown of your society because all of the women are going to tell to their husbands who have been abusing them for a while that, no, I'm not going to be abused anymore. I'm not going to take it anymore. I've had enough. So therefore, the thing that actually scares him, losing Vashti is bad, but the thing that scares him is losing his kingdom. And you have to notice how... By the way, do you all appreciate why I'm telling you that you have to read the whole first chapter much more in terms of politics than you have to read it in terms of religion? This is politics taking place over here. He was just now told you're about to lose all of your ministers because all of their wives are not going to listen to them anymore. And at that point, he loses his country, he loses his government, he loses everything, and that's not something that he's willing to do. And at that point, Vashti disappears. What happens to her? We don't know. And he has to pass a law that all the women should listen to their husbands. I hope you like that. He has to pass a law that women should listen to their husbands. In a normal society, you don't... I'm not going to go there. Right? This is like totally absurd. The whole thing is completely absurd, but that should help us understand. What happens to her? I don't know. The chapter ends, and we're just told... Next chapter begins, Acher Drima Eile, and after a while, when his anger dissipated, Zacharit Vashti Asher Asata V'et Asher Nigzar Aleha. He remembers her and that which was decreed upon her, which means what happened to her is only hinted at, and we're never told what happened to her. What was decreed? What was decreed? Again, I don't know if what comes down to it, he killed her. I don't know if he put her in a dungeon. I don't know if he put her like in the bell tower or something like, you know, in these old movies. I don't know what he did with her. Did he have the guts to kill her? I don't know. Maybe just sent her away. I don't know. But I love the way, this is really my point, I love the way the text articulates his ambivalence by not even telling us what it is that happened to her, rather what he decreed. What did he decree? Well, how do I know that there is ambivalence? Because he couldn't do it by himself. He has to go to his advisors. What do I do? What do you mean, what do you do? Your whole country is going to disappear. Okay. So we have a couple other characters that we need to talk about. We have Mordechai, but Mordechai's boring. Why do you want to talk about nice Jewish men? Forget about that. That's totally boring. We have Esther, and she's obviously going to be the hero of the story, but we're going to wait with Esther. A little delayed gratification over here. We have to wait. But we have to get to the other really bad person, because bad people are so much more interesting, and that is Haman. So, I also have a psychological analysis of Haman, but let's just use a little bit of the text to be able to understand it. One is they were a whole bunch of advisors, and very quickly he becomes the main advisor. So there was something about him that causes a separation between him and the others. Haman also has a particular, and I don't want to call it trait, but need is a better word, that should have been really disturbing to Ahasuerus. It's the thing that he demanded everyone to do. And what was that? Everyone must bow down to him. Which means that Ahasuerus himself is completely intrigued. Sorry. Haman himself is completely intrigued with the idea of power. He loves it. Now, that's a really dangerous combination. And the dance... And that's what I'm going to call it. The dance between Haman and Ahasuerus is a fascinating one because it should have been combustible, it should have exploded, but each one had what the other one needed, even though deep down inside of us, we know they're going to crash and burn at some point, although they're going to need a little help. That we'll get to that as well, but not today. Someone's going to have to help them crash and burn. But the one thing you know so far about him, which is really obvious, everyone's got to bow down to him, he's got this thing about power. Which, by the way, again, can turn to some kind of insecurity. But I want to read to you what I think is a correct diagnosis of Haman, and I actually have two parts of my diagnosis. The first one I think is obvious, and the second one I think is less obvious, but I think both are true. First, I think he suffers from something which is called narcissistic personality disorder. If you know any people like this, they're very exciting, but they will never be healed. Real narcissist personality disorder cannot be healed. And if there's a man that has it, woman after woman after woman after woman end up suffering from somebody like this, but there's something so attractive that makes it very hard just to walk away because the narcissist, well, actually has some things. But let me read the description. Is a personality disorder in which the individual is described as being excessively preoccupied with issues of personal adequacy. So notice, Haman goes crazy when one person doesn't bow down to him. Later on, he's going to actually say, that everything that I have is meaningless. I'm going to come back to this point. Everything I have is meaningless as soon as I see Mordechai, the Jew, who doesn't bow down to me. Because it all goes down, which means if you yourself feel good about yourself, you're not going to define yourself in terms of the way that somebody treated you or didn't treat you. Did that make any sense? Here, let me ask you a question. Should I define my own self-worth based upon students in my class who listen to me or don't listen to me, people who came to class or didn't come to class, people who pay attention or don't pay attention? Should I define my whole personality based upon 18-year-old students? Yes or no? Well, you don't even like my question. Do you feel bad for somebody who's a teacher who says, you know, their whole life is based upon how students are going to treat them in one particular day? Listen, I know some days I'll have better days and some days I'll have worse days. Some days the worst days have nothing to do with me, but it has to do with how late the student stayed up the night before, right? This has nothing to do with me. We can't define our own adequacy or sense of adequacy based upon other people. We have to have enough sense in ourselves, feel good enough about ourselves that not everything about us is just based upon other people's interpretations of who we are. Correct? Yes, correct. Narcissistic personality disorder is a personality disorder in which the individual is described as being excessively preoccupied with issues of personal adequacy, power, prestige, and vanity. How does that sound so far for Haman? This condition affects 1% of the population. It's a psychopathological disorder characterized by delusional fantasies of power, relevance, or omnipotence. So he can come into the king. Oh, who would the king want to honor other than me? Right? And things like this. But there's another part of him that I want to focus on. And that is when he, if I'm not mistaken, he suffers from something else. And this I've never seen anybody else say, but I think it's true, and I think I can convince you that I'm right. And that is, I think he also suffers from bipolar disorder. So let me read to you a little bit of bipolar disorder, and it's going to explain the relationship a little bit better. Bipolar disorder, previously known as manic depression. Now, why do they call it manic depression? See, bipolar means a pole, like North Pole, South Pole, extremes. Most people don't hit the highs when somebody is manic, and most people don't hit the lows. Most of us live someplace in the middle. Yes, there are days we're happier, and there are days that we're sadder. There are days that are good, and there are days that are bad, and there are days that 1 hour was good, or 10 minutes was good, and the next 10 minutes were not as good, but we don't go crazy on one side or the other. And then there are people that when they fall so deep, and it's so dark, and it's so difficult, and they don't even know how they can even pull themselves out of that, which means they end up laying down in bed, and they can't get out of bed because it's dark. When I say dark, I'm not talking about, I'm saying emotionally. Everything is so dark, and tomorrow's not going to be better, and the next day's not going to be better, and the next day's not going to be better, and you just get stuck in this depression. But I want to go back to this bipolar or manic depression. The manic individual also, the high is so much higher, and the low is so much lower, which means it's the extremes that the person experiences. And once the extremes are so much greater, then when you go from that incredible high and fall all the way at the incredible fall, it ends up becoming incredibly debilitating. But this is what I think is important. I think Haman really was bipolar. And I think during his periods of being high, he was able to accomplish an incredible amount. What did that do for Ahasuerus? Essentially what it did for him, that he can be busy womanizing, sleeping with whoever he wants to, drinking as much as he wants to, and somebody else is running the country. Which means you have one guy who is incredibly capable, but he's only capable when he is really manic. And what makes him manic? When people, you know, give him his honor, people give him his kavod, when people bow down to him. So Ahasuerus, who I agree with you, is a much better observer of human characteristics than we normally would give him credit for. He knows that this is a dangerous place to go, that everyone's got to bow down to Haman. But in the larger scheme of things, it's a small price to pay in order to get him to be able to run everything and keep him manic, keep him really flying high, because then everything works out the way that it's supposed to. And those times that he falls and gets depressed, then nothing works the way that it's supposed to. So essentially, Ahasuerus is smart enough to know that this is a great right-hand man, and he just got to feed his ego. Keep feeding his ego, and this guy can do anything, and will do anything, and that, I think, is pretty much the beginning of the relationship. So, we have a problem. And what's the problem? The problem is that Ahasuerus has now lost his queen. Now make no mistake about it, and do not confuse two different things that have nothing to do with one another. They do in a perfect world, but they don't do in Ahasuerus's world. And that is his problem of having a queen and his problem of having companionship. Those things are not very well correlated. So what is the solution? The solution is to have our very famous beauty contest. Now, you all know that it's not really a beauty contest, correct? What actually is the contest? What are the rules of this contest? Right. So the rules is, okay, it is a sleeping contest. It is not even sleeping. Even that is being nice, right? We're being nicer than we should be, but what can we do? We're nice, decent people. It's a sex contest. By the way, beauty contests, I hope you all realize, are completely sexist, right? How do you get to a contest which is more sexist than a beauty contest? Make it this contest. I also don't know if you've noticed, but he does more than one, even afterwards. He makes another one along the way at some point. What happens if you lose the contest? What happens to you then? What was the reward for losing? You don't remember. You become part of his harem. That means that you... Which means everybody involved in this is permanently going to be connected to Ahasuerus. If you lose, you get put into a place where all a harem, where all of the women stay, and he can have sex with you anytime that he wants. If you win the contest, you become the queen. So most people involved in this contest very much wanted to win. So you have a bunch of Persian women who are wearing too much makeup, too much perfume, who are probably incredibly interested aggressively in winning this, and most likely Ahasuerus has a takeaway and a thought about them, but I want to hold off for 1 second. I've asked this question in different ways. One way that I've asked this is totally wasting the whole class and not teaching anything, which I didn't do today. I did teach today. Was by asking if we were to make a movie involved in the story of Esther, who would be the various actors or actresses that you would use to fill the various parts. The reason I like doing that is I think it's a great way to really think about the characters and who they are and how they should be and so on and so forth. So I think it's an important thought. But I've also asked it differently, that if Esther were alive today, which high school would she have gone to? You know, was she a Shalhevet girl? Was she, meaning, just, it also is something really interesting.
Valley Torah.
But I'm saying that itself is interesting, just in terms of the difference. See, Esther does something really interesting. Well, let me ask it all a little differently. And we're going to end with this today. Why does she win? Because she plays hard to get. Because men ultimately want what they can't have. Which means all the ones that they can have, okay, you become the ones that we date. But there's somebody else who you marry. And I'm saying that itself is really interesting. But why else does she win? You're right, but why else does she win? There's a deeper point to it, or a deeper way of saying it. Esther doesn't want the perfume. She doesn't want this. She doesn't want the... Why does she win? So I'm going to say it again. All the other women are probably very aggressive in their attempt to win the contest. And she was completely, completely disinterested. And she was completely detached from him emotionally. All the others were throwing themselves at him, and because all the others wanted to win. They wanted to become queen. She doesn't want to become queen. She does not want to have a relationship with him. She is emotionally distanced from him and physically distanced from him. And she is much shyer and she is much more reserved. And why does she win?
Because he wanted...
I'll say it a different way.
She's like,
oh, exactly. That she is, and it's actually the distance there is what makes her like, which means she reminds Ahasuerus of queen. You're the one who could be queen because she seems the most regal. She's the, and all the other ones are very undignified, and that's why all the other ones end up being put in the harem. You guys are really good for sex, so that's what I'm going to do with you. I'm going to put you there. But there's only one that reminds him of a queen, and that's Esther, and that's why she wins. Okay, we have everything that we need now to be able to understand the story. So we got the whole background down, and now we have to understand what happens next. We'll do that next time.